Good morning. You've tuned in to 88.5 KRFY, and this is North Idaho News of the Week. I'm Jack Peterson, and with me is Will Love. Good morning, Will.
Good morning. How are you doing, Jack?
I'm doing all right. It's a beautiful summer morning in mid-July. Can't ask for too much more than that.
No, for sure. We were out on the lake last night. It was beautiful. And then tried to stay up to see the Northern Lights.
I couldn't make it.
Yeah. Beautiful. It's the reason why we're here, right?
That's right. Yes. Pretty much. This is the reason why so many of us are here, other than the skiing folks, I think. They're just waiting for this whole thing to be over so they can get back on the mountain. But we're here to talk about news, and we're going to start with just an update.
Hey, Jack, it's been a sneaky week of news.
Yeah.
I emailed you yesterday. I was like, doesn't seem like a whole lot happened. And then digging in, like, there's quite a bit of stuff.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, the week after the 4th of July, it seemed like it was just a quiet week. And then, yes, as we opened up the paper, it was like, oh, there's stuff going on. We want to start with a wildfire update, I think, because that's what's first and foremost on a lot of people's minds. It's still clear. I mean, you were looking for the Northern Lights. It's still clear in our area right now. I should say smoke-wise, it's clear in our area right
that's
now.
That's me knocking on wood right there.
Yeah. Closest to us, there's two fires close to us. And more going on, of course, around the country and the continent. But closest to us is the B-Top Fire, which is up Lightning Creek Road. That is, when did that start? Hold on one second.
A couple weeks ago.
Yeah. I think it started on the 30th, if I'm not mistaken. And was a, let's see. Yeah. I think it started on the 30th and is, or no, the 1st of July. It's a 45 acre fire and is 35% contained right now with no forecast for any kind of evacuations or anything like that. It looks like they've got 128 people on the fire, two engines, three helicopters, and three hand crews. The Boise Interagency Hotshot crew is on site to test hose lay and pumps along the lower contingency line adjacent to Lightning Creek, which is a little too jargony for me to even really understand.
They're fighting fires.
They're fighting fires, and it seems like this one they have, I mean, the percentage that they have contained keeps going up. I think last week it was at 28, now it's at 35, so hopefully that means, unless we get a big wind or something like that, hopefully that means that this is a fire that's they're going to continue to have under control.
Yeah, last week I took a friend out there, and the road's still open. And that's a pretty popular road for people to go and recreate. And so we went fly fishing, and all of a sudden looked up, and there was a helicopter right overhead. And so while we were fishing constantly for about an hour, we could hear the chainsaws, and the helicopter came over several times and stuff. So
It's actually really cool to see if, I'm always fascinated by seeing them do that. Although, of course, you wish they didn't have to do it at all.
Yeah.
The other one is actually a much bigger fire, which is not, even though, you know, B-Top is maybe more visible to us because Lightning Creek is a well-traveled road. And, you know, we know folks that live up there, but not far from us is the Consalis fire. And I was able to get somebody on the phone from that fire complex up there, and I'm going to play that brief conversation we had this morning right now. So here we go. Okay, can you hear me, Jenny?
I can. Yep.
Okay.
You must be radio.
That's correct, and I can hear you.
Okay.
Can you just introduce yourself and what you know your title role in the operation?
Yeah, my name's Jenny Garson, and I'm the public information officer on the Consalis Fire.
Thanks. I guess I just have a couple of questions about the Consalis Fire, which is it says on the internet it's about 10% contained and 305 acres right now. Is that up to date?
That is up to date, yep.
Okay. What kind of equipment and personnel is on site fighting the fire right now?
We have a lot of resources working on this fire. We've got a heavy equipment task force. We've got dozers, a masticator, a feller buncher. We have a couple of interagency hotshot crews and several hand crews. We've got helicopters working the fire. We've got the super scooper planes available to us as needed to help cool the fire's edge, help the firefighters on the ground. And then obviously we have a lot of resources supporting all those firefighters out there on the fire.
Yeah. It looks like there's just one road closure. Is that right? In the area?
Yeah, there's two partial road closures, Forest Service Road 1108 and 1094 have pieces of them closed. And then there's several roads in the vicinity that we are asking folks to try to stay off of if they're able to, just because we've got a lot of personnel out there, a lot of heavy equipment, a lot of traffic on those roads, and we want people, both the public and the firefighters, to be safe. And then also there's the Crystal Mine is up there, and we're asking people to please park off the side of the road if they can, rather than in the road so equipment can move through.
Yeah. Hot weather coming this weekend. Do you know how that's going to affect what goes on up there?
Yeah, weather always plays a role in fighting these fires, and we do spot forecasts and have weather briefings every day. So crews and fire managers are always paying attention to what those conditions bring. Hot, dry weather may see increased fire activity, but we are getting some good line around much of the perimeter of the fire. So we'll keep going but folks, the public may see increased smoke if some of the activity in the interior, picks up.
Okay. Any chance of evacuations coming up in the future or anything if things don't get under control?
Right now, everything looks good. Mm-hmm. It's wildfire, so that can always change. And if weather conditions change or something, doesn't hold like we would like it to, everybody this time of year that lives in areas with wildfires should be in ready mode, which means, have a plan, have your stuff ready, know what you're going to take. Again, nobody's in evacuation. There's no evacuation status in place, but it is wildfire season, so it's always good to be heads up about it and be paying attention to what's going on in the community around you with these wildfires.
Sure. Hey, well, thank you for talking to us this morning, Jenny. Is there anything else, I guess, you can tell us about the fire that I didn't ask about?
I think, as always, the firefighters on the ground are working really hard. They work long shifts, and they're doing great work out there. So we always appreciate the hard work they're putting in and always want the public to know that.
Okay. Thank you. Good luck out there. And we'll perhaps talk to you later on as things develop.
That sounds good. You said your name was Jake Peterson?
Jack Peterson. That's right.
Jack. Okay.
You
perfect.
Got it.
Just need to put it in my log. So thank you very much, Jack.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Have a nice day. Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
There you have it. We're back live in the studio. Jack Peterson and Will Love here.
Not Jake.
Yeah, not Jake Peterson. That's right. Nice of her to ask.
Yeah.
I guess, it's a real, a really well-run operation. Obviously, they've been fighting fires in the West for more than 100 years now, and they know what they're doing. I called the number. I think she answered on, the first ring and just had everything she wanted, every detail that I asked about, she knew exactly what to say, and then she's keeping track of who calls and where they're calling from and everything like that.
Unfortunately, yeah. It's become the norm. So obviously you can see that they're used to this kind of stuff. My father worked for the Idaho Department mm-hmm. of Lands and was on fires during his career, and mm-hmm. I know that. It's a finely tuned machine.
Yeah. Hey, you're listening to the News of the Week from 88.5 KRFY, North Idaho News of the Week, and we want to run down the top stories in our local media and media from elsewhere that affects us here. Item number one on our agenda here is the Idaho Open Primary Initiative developments. The open primary supporters, we knew that when last we covered this story last week, we knew that a lawsuit was probably forthcoming from the supporters of the Open Primary Initiative, who were going to sue the Attorney General of the state of Idaho, Raul Labrador, because of the titles that he had applied to the proposed ballot initiative. That suit was filed on Monday, and I'm going to read here from the Idaho Capital Sun, an article by Clark Corbin. Supporters of the proposed open primary ballot initiative filed a legal challenge asking the Idaho Supreme Court to throw out ballot titles for the initiative assigned by Attorney General Raul Labrador's office. In the filing July 10th, the groups Idahoans for Open Primaries and Reclaim Idaho alleged that Labrador's office provided misleading ballot titles. Quote, the titles assigned by the Attorney General contain material inaccuracies concerning the nature and purpose of the initiative and reflect his public opposition to it, unquote. That is the reading of the court filing. If successful, the ballot initiative would end Idaho's, this is the summary of the proposed ballot initiative. It would end Idaho's closed primary political elections and replace them with one primary, which all candidates can run in and all voters can vote in, regardless of the party affiliation. In the filing, Idahoans for Open Primaries and Reclaim Idaho asked the Idaho Supreme Court to instead use ballot titles that they have written to describe the initiative. Supporters of the initiative also asked the Idaho Supreme Court to expedite the case and extend the deadline to gather signatures to qualify the ballot initiative for the November 2024 general election. Even under an expedited litigation schedule, this necessary challenge to the Attorney General's deficient ballot titles causes great hardship as it shortens the already limited time to circulate the initiative petition for signatures, as Idahoans for Open Primaries and Reclaim Idaho write in the filing. This delay alone may doom the possibility of the initiative reaching the ballot. The later development, I believe on Wednesday, the court actually handed down asked for Labrador to respond within 14 days. So they are moving forward at a rapid clip, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, well, with Idaho's change in how, you know, the public can bring about an initiative, it is really important. And, you know, obviously, as these groups identify, they need time to be able to get, what is it, 18 counties or something like that, that they've got to get a certain percentage of the vote,
or
enrolled voters and stuff. And so,
I think it's 6%. I can't remember exactly what off the top of my head, but you're right.
The main point is that time is of the essence for this group to get, or these groups to get, the initiative on the 2024 ballot, which seems so far away, but it's not.
No, it's only what, less than 18 months away.
Yeah.
It's closing in, and they need to have the correct ballot titles or whatever the ballot titles are going to be, would hypothetically be on the ballot. They need to have that on any petition that they have people sign, and they need a lot of signatures to actually get the proposed ballot initiative on the ballot. What it would do, to summarize, is it would in two parts. One, there would no longer be multiple primaries for each different party. It would be one general primary, which anyone can run in,
any registered voter can vote in too.
And any registered voter can vote in. That's right. You don't have to be registered with a particular political party to cast your vote. And then the top four finishers from that one primary would appear on the general election ballot in November of whatever year this would take place. And then and then of those four, voters could choose up to all four of them and rank them in order of preference, or they can just vote for one person or two or three. And then that would go to an instant runoff voting where the first the person with the least number of votes would be eliminated, and their those voters would have their second choice cast for, you know, and eliminated until there was just one winner of the general election.
It's
hard to talk about, by the way, because we're talking about an election. I mean, we're talking about having something on the ballot, which would then be for future ballots. It gets confusing.
It does. But, ultimately it revolutionized the way that we vote here in Idaho.
It's not, I don't know if there's anything exactly like it, elsewhere in the country, but I know that, Alaska has passed an instant runoff voting thing. And I think Maine, it's not totally unheard of.
The ranked balloting, some states have it, and, I know some friends that, they appreciate it, that are in some of those states, but for the system that we have right now in Idaho, this would be a major change.
Yeah. The titles, by the way, that Labrador's office, supplied were as follows. Measure 2-1, replace voter selection of party nominees with non-party blanket primary, and 2, require ranked choice voting for general elections. What the Reclaim Idaho and the open primary supporters, Idahoans for open primaries, what they suggested instead that it be replaced with this language, quote, an initiative to allow all Idaho voters the right to participate in open primary elections and to establish an instant runoff general election, end quote. So that is that's basically the difference in language, which kind of is significant.
I think very significant.
Yeah.
People go into these elections and read that, and they might not be as up to date on what this means. And so, I think this is you can see, why Reclaim Idaho and the other group would want to have this written the way that they want it to have it written.
Right. And I think there's a number of ways it could end up going. It could be that the judge could just adopt that other language, or it could be that they have a third party write the language, or they could just demand that Labrador submit something else.
Right. Yeah. And I think, the other big part of this story is that Attorney General Labrador has come out and he's against this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, right. Very, very much against this.
Right.
There's a tweet where he said we need to defeat stuff like this. And then also in the article, it cites through, I think, an email that the Attorney General's office will fight this if it gets passed.
Right. So and it doesn't,
or even if it gets onto the ballot, I guess.
Yeah. Right. That he'll contest it. And it does seem like he's kind of showing his hand there with the language that he suggests. On to item number 2 here, from the Reader, Zach Agadon has an article, Council Adopts Civility and Decorum Ordinance. New code section would trespass public for range of disruptive, threatening behaviors. This kind of reflects on the city, Sandpoint City Council, of course, but the kind of general tenor of meetings.
Most government entities. Yeah,
I would say so. Yeah. Pretty much every board or public hearing seems like it's become rather contentious of late. The first couple sentences here: city civility governing interactions between the public and staff at City Hall, as well as decorum at public meetings, are at the core of a new ordinance approved July 5th by the Sandpoint City Council. A pattern on a similar measure in Norwalk, California, Sandpoint's ordinance is, quote, intended to dispel disruptive behavior during meetings, unquote, City Attorney Andy Doman told councilors. It goes on to say that the law has been, I mean, the template law that was passed in California has been tested by, I think, the 12th Circuit, or what?
The Ninth Circuit.
Which, and has passed, so it does appear to be something legal and not, or constitutional anyway, so as far as we know. But it does contain the following language. It bans insulting, demeaning, intimidating, or offensive remarks or other communications, harassment or intimidation of any City of Sandpoint staff, elected official, or other member of the public, willful destruction or damage of property, conduct that threatens or provokes a violent reaction, continually disruptive behavior in the lobbies, offices or meeting rooms of Sandpoint City Hall or other facilities where official city business is being conducted by city officials or staff, and repetitive calls, visits, or correspondence to city offices or staff with an associated pattern of disruptive behavior, including verbal or physical aggression and or threats regarding an issue for which city officials or staff has already provided pertinent information or instructions. It passed unanimously. Councillor Deb Rule cast the lone dissenting vote on the procedural motion to suspend the three separate readings of the ordinance. It's supposed to be read three times, and I think as a matter of course, they often suspend that so they don't have to read it out loud three times. But she
now this did go over some changes since what was it, March?
It was proposed, introduced in May 17th.
Okay.
Yeah, and then tabled until July 5th to hammer out some additional details and fine-tune language. The ordinance was not created in a vacuum, Andy Doman said, researching other ordinances in different municipalities and based on discussion that took place before, during, and after the COVID-19 pandemic, a period when public meetings took on an increasing and continuing rancorous tone, in the words of the inimitable Zach Hagedon.
I think one of the interesting things is that, meetings, mm-hmm. these are business meetings a lot of times that these entities are going through. And so they're trying mm-hmm. to get business done. And so, you know, I think, ultimately, if you're disrupting that, disrupts the government's ability to govern, I guess. But on the other hand, is some people that are against this brought out, like, you know, what does this exactly mean? Is this maybe a slippery slope when we start to get into the ideas of, I guess, demeaning or intimidating? What exactly does that mean? Because intimidating can be seen differently between different people. You know?
Yeah. Is it a little too vague, perhaps, because it's so, you can certainly understand how active city member, an active citizen could be just exercising their rights, and a city council could perhaps ban them from the premises just for nothing illegal that they do, or nothing heretofore illegal anyway.
Right.
I'll read the former mayor, Kerry Logan, who has a quote in the article, said that the city's long tradition of robust public engagement, quote, has suffered in recent years. The ordinance before you tonight further limits opportunities for public involvement, she said in May, later calling it very chilling. Or is the city just tired of people talking about issues and challenging staff decisions, she said. Don't get your feelings hurt if the speakers don't agree with you. So that's kind of the flip side of it, is mm-hmm. that are they just trying to shut down their critics and, you know, not listen to the public when the public is not in favor of the, you know, or when certain members of the public are not in favor of the direction the city council is taking. But as you said, it's you got to have sympathy for city council, too, who are just trying to do their jobs. And it's difficult.
Yeah. And then, you know, obviously we see it played out with the county commissioners, because mm-hmm. they haven't taken public comment for, the last couple of weeks.
That's right. Yeah. Actually, that dovetails nicely with this article from Lauren Reichenbach in the Daily Bee from the 12th. again, no public comments at the Bonner County Commissioners Tuesday meeting after Commissioner Steve Bradshaw, who is the chair of the commission, once more called a recess almost immediately after the meeting started. He began the meeting by reading a Bonner County ordinance regarding the commissioner meetings. The ordinance stated that the meetings are for the board to conduct business publicly as required by law. Regular business meetings, this is a quote from Bradshaw, regular business meetings do not constitute a public hearing wherein the public has a right to be heard on every agendized item. However, at the discretion of the chair, everyone may be afforded an opportunity to speak on a particular issue if recognized by the chair. Any unrecognized comment or disruptive behavior will be grounds for removal. Those meetings have been, if anything, more contentious, I think, than the city council meetings. And there's not just with the members of the public, but also among the commissioners themselves.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing is that there's a vigorous debate on a lot of issues that are coming up before the county commissioners, among the county commissioners themselves.
Yeah. And Commissioner Asia Williams was seemingly pretty opposed to this decision by the chairman. As he walked out of the room, Commissioner Asia Williams asked if she could challenge his decision. He briefly paused and told Williams she could do whatever she wanted, but the meeting was recessed. And then Bradshaw left. His response did not satisfy Williams, who continued speaking to the audience, contending that he did not, in fact, have the power to deny the public a comment section. The comment period is not part of the agenda, she said. It's actually before the agenda. I don't know that there is an authority that can be appealed to here. I mean, it seems like they're just of two differing opinions. Bradshaw's the chairman, and so probably what he says goes, but Asia Williams can stay there and listen to public comment, whether he's in the room or not. I don't know.
Yeah. No, for sure. And I think, you know, here when we start to look at the structures of these boards, you know, we see a title like chairman or chair. And all of a sudden, you know, in cases like this, you do see the power that that person holds in having that title.
Let's talk about schools briefly. An update. We did talk about West Bonner County schools last week on the show, but the drama goes on in West Bonner County. The school board trustees are facing the recall election in that that election, I think, was still not officially underway when last we met this time last week, but it is that they will be on the ballot on August 29th. And the two members of the board are the West Bonner County School District Chair, Keith Rutledge, and Vice Chair, Susan Brown. They submitted written rebuttals to the county clerk's office this week. The result of weeks of discord between patrons and trustees over the selection of new superintendent Brandon Durst, a former Democratic lawmaker and Republican state superintendent candidate who most recently was an analyst for the Idaho Freedom Foundation. What Brown wrote, since being elected, I have dedicated hundreds of hours to holding our district administration accountable to its residents and keeping woke liberal agendas out of our district, she said in her prepared statement. As for Rutledge's response, let's see. He said, your no vote will enable this board to keep building better outcomes for our district children, their families, and all the residents who support it. In his statement, Rutledge asked voters to keep a conservative majority on the school board. If he successfully recalled, control will be given back, as he says, to the very same people that are responsible for 60% reading competency rates and call that a success. If you want a board member who will fight for financial transparency, work to keep our schools free of woke agendas, and demand educational outcomes better than 60% competency for our children, vote against the recall. That was actually from Trustee Brown. Rutledge mentions CRT and LGBTQ plus agendas, and they defend their investigation into the Wonders K-12 curriculum, riddled with critical race theory derived teaching methods, and was over budget. they thought that it, you know, they sent it back basically after having approved it, which was a costly move. That and they have plenty of budget problems going on besides that.
Now, Chairman Rutledge mm-hmm. was also, I guess they termed it as a town hall meeting mm-hmm. that he was participated in recently, where I think he, you know, the candor was a lot more, okay, this is how I feel about these types of things. Mm-hmm. I sounded like it was about 20 minutes where he spoke to people at the Trinity Baptist Church and just went through the different points of, you know, that he sees in this whole situation that, you know, when we start to look at it, it is thick with lots of different tentacles and stuff.
They also in, I think this was just in today's paper, the lack of details sparked doubt at West Bonner budget meeting. Their meeting on Wednesday, the new superintendent, Brandon Durst, and the board of trustees came out with a proposed budget, but it was not a full budget. It was just a summary budget, not very specific. And they roughly came out and said that they would be funding extracurricular and co-curricular activities to 75% of the level, I guess, of full funding. So presumably that means that parents or students will have to be raising a certain amount of money to participate in.
Yeah. And so I think they went through mm-hmm. and came up with some ideas as far as how mm-hmm. they could kind of cover those costs. I think some of those included just actual fundraisers within the community to kind mm-hmm. of make up that difference. And then, or also what you hear as pay to play, that families mm-hmm. would have to pay a certain amount for their kids to participate in activities there, you know, and probably here there's lots of activities, but you know, what probably most people think of is especially extracurricular are the sports. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I know that it's kind of up in the air really, like, okay, is Priest River going to have this team? Is Priest River going to have that team? I think mm-hmm. they have committed to doing some stuff in the fall. Mm-hmm. But I was talking to a coach that is in their league a couple weeks ago, and essentially, like, the state had to force Priest River to participate in some of these games. That was according to this coach. And so, yeah, you know, when you're taking 25% of that budget away, you know, I'm guessing that is going to mean a lot less games than what you typically see. Mm-hmm. They also talked about, you know, coaches not being paid, you know, and so there's a lot of options on the board, on the table. But ultimately, you know, high school sports, high school athletics, it starts in about 3 weeks officially.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's not much time here for families to get prepared, or, you know, what are these fundraisers going to be that will kind of fill in mm-hmm. the 25% or so that is apparently going to be cut from those activities.
Yeah. The difference between the first proposed budget on June 22nd and the second on July 7th, by the way, is a salary reduction. That is the only number that's different on the proposed budget than the Pride budget. So they have proposed reducing salaries by $276,763 total, which is seems like a lot. As some of the public comments said already, the pay for teachers in that district is lower than any of the surrounding areas. they of course earlier had the West Bonner County School District had rejected a levy, which kind of is what put them into this budgetary shortfall. And they're now dipping into savings, it looks like, to pay for ongoing expenses, which is not necessarily a fiscally healthy thing to do.
Right. And, mm-hmm. But it does sound like they are going to go after another levy, which was, I mm-hmm. think, one of the things, you know, when Brandon Durst was brought up, you know, was it with, you know, are they going to go after these levies? And it sounds like, you know, they're talking about the timing. So it seems like it's something that the board does want to do. You know, I think they could run a levy in August, but, you know, in the reading or the discussion at the, it just the time wise, like putting all of that together would just be really, really hard. So I can't remember what the next date is. It might be November that they could run a levy election. And so it does sound like they're going to go after that money again. Now, how big that levy will be, we'll see.
Yeah. One more thing from Education News. NIC, we mentioned last week that they may have been on the verge of losing their accreditation. North Idaho College does remain accredited, though it will continue to operate under a show cause sanction. The Northwest Commission on Colleges and Universities issued its decision to extend the sanction last Friday. It is considered a neutral decision. This path equates to no change in the college's current status for a period of 1 year or less. At the end of an extension, the NWCCU may reaffirm accreditation, take adverse action, or consider a second and final extension of 1 year or less. So they kind of remain in a probationary state, but they have not yet lost their accreditation. They'll continue for up to a year in their current state,
yeah, and there's kind of three options, it sounds like, that, you know, one, in a year they could become accredited, two, they could lose their accreditation, or three, they could get another 1 year show cause if it looks like they are trying to deal with the issues that are kind of brought up. But, you know, it sounds like too that there's going to be several steps over the next year that NIC is going to have to go through. And I think ultimately, you know, what it comes down to is in the article, it's nothing to do with academics. You know, it has all to do with leadership and just them ironing out, okay, who actually is in charge here at NIC? And then also probably working out some of the issues that have come up with the board.
Accreditation.
Yeah,
that's a tricky word for me to say. Lastly, we're over time, but did you want to mention the?
Oh yeah,
since you're here.
Well, yeah, I've got my background in sports, and so this is something I'm kind of interested in. Is that you know, NIC has an athletic program, a robust athletic program that provides opportunities for a lot of regional kids to participate in sports. And so one of the things that they're looking at is changing essentially the governing body that they play under. And so the last few years they've been participating in what's called the NWAC. I'm not sure what that stands for, but NWAC. And so essentially that's a regional governing body that includes Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. So junior college is in there. Now, you know, they kind of go through a season, and then this NWAC has a tournament at the end. What NIC is looking at is, and have actually said that they're going to go forward with, is going to the NJCAA, which is a national governing body. And that was the governing body that they participated in before they went to the NWAC, just in the last decade. And so, Mark Nelke from the Coeur d'Alene Press had a column about this, kind of, okay, you know, what's the situation here? Why is this happening? But ultimately, kind of going back to the days that NIC was in this national governing, playing under this national governing body, and they played in the Scenic West Athletic Conference, the SWAC, which included College of Southern Idaho, at the time would be Ricks College, BYU Idaho, although they no longer have sports, and then you know, there were several Utah schools in this conference, and it was a really, really good conference on a number of levels, but ultimately, you know, what does this mean is that right now in the NWAC, they're only able to give athletes partial scholarships. I think it's up to 60%. Going under this national, the NJCAA, they'll be able to give out full scholarships for athletes. And so also there isn't as many, restrictions on where you can recruit from. So when, say, like the basketball programs were part of the NJCAA, mm-hmm. they were recruiting all over the country. And so essentially you would have these top level athletes come in that maybe couldn't qualify or weren't ready to play at a 4-year school. Uh-huh. They would come here. And so then you would see, okay, this kid is going to Cincinnati. Gonzaga's recruiting this kid. And so just the level of talent is more at a national level versus a regional level. Now, this is all contingent. And I should say that the wrestling program has continued to play or to compete under this national umbrella. But what will be interesting to kind of see is this accreditation. One of the stipulations is that, you know, you should be accredited.
Right. Yeah.
You can't know, because ultimately, if you're bringing in these kids, they need to have credits that will transfer to, the University of Idaho, or that will transfer to Cincinnati or mm-hmm. Gonzaga and stuff. And if you don't have those credits that will transfer, then it's going to be hard for them to recruit, which would be the same with this NWAC as well. But again, just something to kind of follow, because they have said that they're going to separate from the NWAC and they are going to move into this bigger one. But, you know, it's kind of, like I said, it's up in the air.
Yeah. Well, that's it. We got to go. We're over time. that's the news from us. 87,000 Idahoans so far have been removed from Medicaid, by the way, under their just because they didn't send the state their contact information, and they're only halfway done with the audit. So that's one story we didn't cover yet, and maybe we'll get to it next week. But thanks for joining us here on North Idaho News of the Week. Thanks, Will, for coming in.
Hey, thanks, Jack, and thanks for listening.
Should I say Jake? Yes. Yeah. I still don't have like a sign off. Yeah. I feel like we need a good. That's news.
That's news. That's the news of the week.
And that's the news. Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. Stay tuned for Otto's Eclectic Mix all day long here on 88.5 KRFY. This is Panhandle Community Radio.